Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the FDH Lounge. We have with us, joining us on the program today, shortly, one of our most consistently entertaining conversationalists, Evan Roberts of WFAN in New York. He can, of course, be heard middays on WFAN, which I have previously referred to on the program as sort of the Yankee Stadium of sports broadcasting. He is on from 10 to 1 Eastern Time, Monday through Friday. It's the Joe and Evan Show. You can catch him on there. Going to talk to him briefly about a couple of different topics here today and get his thoughts, as he is one of our more, as I say, consistently entertaining guests and conversationalists that we've had on the program. Going to be speaking to him about some headlines around the NBA with the playoffs going on, and, of course, the NBA being the NBA, the more intriguing news apparently happening off the court. The NFL schedule being released this week, I know he's got some thoughts on that, and WrestleMania 30, is it one of the very best of all time, as I have postulated? So we'll get into all of that with him. Good to see we've got him on the phone lines here. Again, welcome to the program here, everybody. We have with us, as I say, one of our most entertaining conversationalists that we have on. It's Evan Roberts from WFAN in New York. Evan, welcome to the program today, my man. How are you?
Yo, how you doing today, buddy?
Hey, I'm doing fine, Evan. How are you on this fine day?
I'm very nervous. I'm outside the Barclays Center getting ready for a big game three, and I'm not exactly confident, as they say.
Well, yeah, I can identify with that. You sound like you're doing the patented Rick Morris grip before a big game there. Let's start with the NBA. Let's start with that series. That was the one that I thought maybe had the best potential to go seven games going in. I can understand your nerves when you look at it. Yours is a team that built to win now, if not yesterday. Toronto's is a team that's built to win in the future, but there's always the danger that they're going to gel very quickly against an older team like Brooklyn. How are you feeling about this series two games in?
Well, if you would have told me they were going to get a split in Toronto, I'd be thrilled with it, but they had such a golden opportunity in game two to really take a stranglehold on the series. And really the biggest concern about the Nets over the last few months is that they can't rebound the basketball. And it was so horrific in game two that's probably my biggest fear. Also, the fact that Kyle Lowry has just flat out been a better player than Darren Williams, my point guard, who's supposed to be elite. But the Nets have played really well at home so far this season. They had that long winning streak. But the Raptors are a tough team. And even though in game one they showed nerve, you know, DeMar DeRozan could hit a shot in game one, I think after two games in their own building, I think kind of they got their feet wet. So I fully expect there to be a split. And you said best potential to go seven. I've been saying from the beginning I think it does go seven. And I like the Nets' chances of winning a seventh game on the road because of all the veterans. But these two teams are evenly matched. They've been evenly matched all season long when they've played.
They really are. It's an intriguing matchup in that sense, you know, even when you go beyond the older versus younger angle. And what is it, I have to ask you, about Darren Williams? That's a guy where, again, not just over the course of the playoffs, but throughout his career, I mean, he has had some very, very baffling sort of disappearing stretches. What is it about that guy?
I don't know what's happened. I mean, when you read the box scores and the stats from his days in Utah, you figure he's an elite player. Well, I've watched basically every minute of his time in New Jersey and now in Brooklyn, and he hasn't been an elite player. He had a great stretch in the second half of last year after he did that blood-spinning thing or whatever the heck he did. But this year, he just hasn't been the same guy. And he was very aggressive in the first part of game one, and I like that. But you saw the way he shot the basketball in game two. Nothing was going down. I don't know what it is. I can just only tell you what I've seen with my own eyes. And what I've seen with my own eyes is that he's not an elite point guard, and they kind of need him to be, especially if they're going to make any type of deep run. But the best thing the Nets did this year was when they put Sean Livingston in the lineup, so they basically play with two point guards. But I can't explain what's happened to Darren Williams. All I know is that the better point guard in this series plays for Toronto, not for Brooklyn.
Absolutely, and that's kind of a sad thought for Nets fans, no question about that. And, again, when you look at this Brooklyn team. It is a team where, and I understand your trepidation that you expressed at the outset here, because the names are impressive, but again, you know, KG, enough said on his better days being behind him. Paul Pierce, how much longer is he still going to be at the level that he is still at? Darren Williams, like you said, more of a name than a presence there. I can really understand why you would be frightened, and this is a team that could really use some Brook Lopez right about now.
Yeah, they could use his size, there's no question. But I give Coach Kidd credit because they found an identity after Brook went down. They go with this small lineup. They've got great ball movement. They can hit the three, and they defend. Their defense has been a lot better, and their defense was, at least in the first half, part of the reason they even stayed in the game against Toronto. But, you know, they should win this series. They're a very deep basketball team. I think a part of my nerves is that I can't forget last year. I can't forget handing a game away to the Chicago Bulls, in which they're up by about 15 points with 3.5 minutes to go. And I can't get out of my head losing a game 7 in my own building to a Bulls team that actually was about to suit me up at small forward. They were so beset by injuries. So they should win this series. Logic tells me they're going to win this series, but I'm very scarred. I've got scars all over my body from this team, and so my confidence isn't exactly as high as it should be.
Well, something tells me that Mikhail Prokhorov is not going to take any solace from what I'm about to observe here. But when I was saying about some of the more interesting things in the NBA happening off court, really it's Shangri-La what you've got there compared to the mess across town. Phil Jackson coming in to be the savior, quote-unquote, for the Knicks. And I'm sure everyone is really shocked right about now that Jim Dolan is already undermining him and not allowing him to clean house and not giving him the power that was extended to him. So do you think old Phil is already saying, you know, gee, it's a big pile of money, but what did I get myself into?
You know, maybe I'm being naive here. I trust Phil Jackson. I think Phil Jackson's one of the most brilliant basketball minds. I trust him to run my team. And I actually don't believe the stories that Dolan's interfering. And the only reason I don't believe it is that Phil would have fired a grenade at James Dolan a few days ago when he met with the media. If Dolan was doing something, I think he would have said something. And the only thing that Phil said was, hey, so far, and those are key words, so far, Dolan has been true to his word. And I almost took that as, you know what, don't believe what you read, but he better stay far away because I got to be the one to run this team. So I don't know if I fully buy the Daily News report, because I think Phil Jackson's the kind of guy that no matter how much money they're paying him, and I understand $12 million a year is a lot, but Phil Jackson also probably has the biggest ego of anybody. And if Dolan was starting to kind of get involved, Jackson would be the type of guy that would say something about it. That's how he's always operated. He'll always fire something off in the media. So I think as of now, they're letting him do his thing. What I think is interesting is I don't know how much he wants Melo back, because he basically calls it out and says, hopefully Melo stays true to his word and takes less money. Well, it's kind of tough for a guy making $12 million a year to say, well, I want this guy to take less money, because Phil didn't exactly take less money in running the Knicks. So I think what's more interesting right now is, does he even want Carmelo Anthony back? I'm not sure if he does.
Well, that's a great question with all the free agents that may, the big timers that may hit the market this summer. And let's take a look there. Yeah, I mean, if you're implying that Carmelo should take less money, again, any of the super elite players in this league, you just want them to play for your team no matter what. You're not going to sit there and quibble about salary. For Carmelo to, in that sense, be the financial scapegoat for the other bad decisions made, the fact that Amari Stoudemire's knees are pretty much made out of sand right about now, on down the line with the other bad moves that they've made. Yeah, to imply that Carmelo should be the one to pay for that, it's very interesting. I haven't heard anybody else raise the question of it, but it does sort of raise the question, doesn't it? Does he really want him back?
Absolutely. And the other thing is, I hate to be like a Carmelo defender, but whenever people cite the guys who have taken less money, you cite Tim Duncan taking less money to stay with San Antonio. You cite LeBron James. Those guys took less money because they were right there to win an NBA championship. Carmelo Anthony's not right there. So now Carmelo Anthony needs to take less money to stay with a team that's far away from winning at all. It's kind of asking a lot from the guy. I mean, I'm not exactly the president of the Carmelo Anthony fan club, but to put it on him, like you said, to take less money because of the other financial decisions that have been made, and to take less money for the hope, not the guarantee, the hope that you can sign Rajon Rondo, the hope that you could sign Kevin Love, that's asking a lot. And I got to tell you, if I'm Carmelo Anthony, if I'm taking less money, I'm taking less money in Chicago, not Madison Square Garden.
I totally agree with that. And again, Tim Duncan is really the best example of what you pointed out there, because at the risk of sounding like a bitter Cavs fan, if we go back and examine the history, LeBron in the end didn't have to settle for less money. I'm sure Pat Riley told him, look, we're going to try and work out a sign and trade, and they did. And I'm sure LeBron wasn't sitting there saying, oh, no, please don't give up any assets to the Cavaliers just to get me my full bank. So in the end, it really pretty much is Tim Duncan being the only one that really had to do that.
He is. And look, I feel bad for LeBron leaving Cleveland, trust me, but if you look at it and you see that he had a chance to play with Dwayne Wade, a chance to play with Chris Bosh, but even more than that, a chance to put his feet in a pool every single morning, an outdoor pool, not an indoor pool in the middle of Cleveland. I mean, it's tough to really blame the guy. Look, trust me, it would have been a great story if he brought Cleveland a championship, being an Akron kid. But the truth of the matter is, don't you look at what LeBron decided to do and say, you know what, it really wasn't that bad of a decision. It's how he made the decision that was bad.
Well, I always said, too, and I don't know how much of this made its way to New York, but it was the way that he basically ran the organization for 7 years. Everyone always said, oh, the bad moves that they made. Every bad move they made was with his gun to their head and like, hey, you better do this or I might leave. And then in the end, he leaves anyways. I think we had this discussion at about the time of the thing here and kind of left him holding the bag. That was what was dishonest, I thought.
No, I agree with you. I think that part, the fact he goes on TV, all that type of stuff was wrong. I think he could have done everything a lot better, but the decision he made in the end is a good one, and I will do my best, I promise you. If the Brooklyn Nets advance against Toronto, they're 4-0 against LeBron and the Miami Heat this year. We will do our best to bring down the King. We'll do it for you.
I have nothing against the Nets, so this doesn't exactly apply, but the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So, yeah, I'll have the pom-poms out for the Nets. I will be right there with you on that. And again, ever since the summer of 2010, with the outs that were signed in the contract, people were looking ahead now to 2014. That's just the nature of it. So, number of big ones that can hit the market this year. You got LeBron, you got Wade possibly, although I don't know how long the line's going to be for him with his knees, but Carmelo. Do you see any really big moves happening akin to what we saw last summer with Dwight Howard?
No, you know, the only thing I can see really happening is Minnesota realizing they've got to trade Kevin Love because there's no way Kevin Love is going to stay there. So I think there's a possibility that a team like the Knicks tries to put a package together to get Kevin Love, a team like the Lakers tries to put a package together. But I don't necessarily think LeBron and Wade are going to opt out. I think they're going to wait another year. And then the year after that, you've got all those free agents. You got Rondo, you got Love, you got LaMarcus Aldridge who's putting on a show during the playoffs. So I don't know if there's going to be anything too major, but I do think there's a good chance Minnesota wises up and trades Kevin Love now before they're really forced to.
Absolutely. And again, Kevin Love, good friends with, very close friends with Kyrie Irving. So the dreaming goes on and on, I'm afraid, Evan. You never know how that might pan out. And the Cavs certainly do have some assets and some cap room. So we'll see how that shakes out. Turning to the NFL, taking a look here, I know that you've been breaking down on your program the NFL schedule coming out this week. And again, everyone was waiting to see what was going to happen opening night, because it's a tradition for the champions to open at home, at least generally. It didn't happen for Denver or for Baltimore last year. They had to play in Denver, but generally at home. Seattle, Green Bay being the opener. Good move by the NFL, do you think, to hold off on the Denver and San Francisco games? What do you think about that as a season tone setter?
I think it's appealing. I mean, I think the fact that you've got yourself Aaron Rodgers, who we missed for a good chunk of the year last year, I think the biggest thing I took out of this whole schedule thing was the fact that the NFL doesn't trust the Seahawks to play home games in prime time because they're concerned Seattle's going to blow everybody out. I think that's comical. I think that's flattering. And I think that's also kind of strange all in one breath. I mean, that's, I think, the only – that home opener that you just mentioned is the only time they're playing a prime time home game, which is insane for a team that right now is the most popular team in the NFL as far as the star power that they have and the fact that they're defending Super Bowl champions and all that. They play in a building that's become famous because of their dominant home field advantage, yet the NFL's afraid to put them in their own building because of the fact that they're so good. But I like the opener, and the truth is, you can give me any game on that Thursday night. I'm sorry, you can give me the Jacksonville Jaguars against the Buffalo Bills on opening night. You're giving me real football for the first time in how many months? I'm ready. Seriously, you can give me the Cleveland Browns, Jacksonville Jaguars. I'm in. Sign me up. Let's play the game. No offense to the Browns, by the way.
Browns, Jaguars. As a Browns fan, I say, hold on a second there. But, no, I hear what you're saying. I mean, it'll be great to see it back. It'll be great to see a game of that caliber. no question about it. The whole thing about Seattle with the home games, is it a little bit still, and I ask you this as somebody working in the media capital of the world, is there still a little bit of fear on the NFL's part of, well, yes, they are the Super Bowl champions, but they're still a small market team, and woe is us if it's not somebody from a metropolis who's dominating. Is there a little bit of that media fear left on the part of the NFL?
There shouldn't be. The NFL is so king that I don't think the media market should matter, and I don't think it matters. And I think the Seahawks, on a lot of levels, are one of the most appealing teams in the NFL to watch. A, to see if they can do it again, the personalities they have on their team, the quarterback. So I think in the NFL more than any other sport, I don't think the media market really matters. I think it's all about the sport. It's about the shield, as they like to say. It's more about that than anything else. And I think Seattle's an appealing team. So I don't think that the media market they play in affects them at all or should affect them at all.
No, it definitely shouldn't. And again, we had talked about this going into the season here, the sense that the Seattle and San Francisco is going to be the rivalry of the decade. It certainly played out that way this past year. And again, probably the most thrilling NFL game of the year, that NFC Championship game. And it made up for, I'm sure, what was a lackluster Super Bowl. But the way that they did it, where they first face each other on Thanksgiving night, obviously that's going to be a hell of a crescendo for the day. Then meeting again 17 days later, your thoughts on not spacing that out a little bit more? I mean, I'm sure the NFL thinks they have a plan there, but I'm just not quite sure myself what it might be.
I think, if anything, and it seems like there's a lot of divisional opponents that play, they don't play until late in the year. I think the Jets kind of do that with the Patriots a little bit. They did that with the – actually, it's with the Dolphins, and they did that last year as well. I think, if anything, mm-hmm. and I don't know if this is a stretch or me just trying to figure it out, is that Thanksgiving night game, which is, I mean, incredibly appealing. With that being the first time they're playing all year, maybe that adds to the intrigue that for the first time we get to see that rematch on Thanksgiving, which is certainly one of the days they want to get a huge number for. So maybe holding that off until then adds to it. I'm not too sure what their thinking is, but I do agree with you on that rivalry right now is fast becoming the best in football, and it's probably going to remain the best in football for a very long time in that division.
You got to think so. Now, that's, of course, assuming that everything can be held together in San Francisco. And, again, I guess the general manager was trying to tamp down any of the rumors about that dissatisfaction with Jim Harbaugh. But very similar to in the NBA right about now, where if Indiana actually was insane enough to fire Frank Vogel if they don't make out of the first round, which I don't believe for a minute, how insane is it going to be in San Francisco there if there becomes a market for Jim Harbaugh or if he is perhaps a tradable asset, as the rumors have gone?
You know, when that first came out, my reaction was, that's got to be the most insane thing I've heard. I mean, here's a guy that is one of the most elite head coaches in the sport. He's an amazing head coach. The Niners have had great success. What the hell are they thinking? But when you look at his personality, maybe he does have the personality that kind of it expires, if you will, that it expires with players, that he's not the kind of guy that can coach a team for 10 years. And the fact that there's already rumblings about unhappiness there and the fact that he is a tradable asset, it's stunning. But then when you think about it, maybe he's just not the type of coach that can last a long period of time. And that certainly puts a chink in the armor as far as the Niners being, you know, on the par of the Seattle Seahawks for a bunch of years of being arch rivals. And that would certainly put a big hindrance in the Niners' success. But it's odd to think about because he's, from a success standpoint, if you look at what he's accomplished in his first few years as a head coach, it's almost unmatched when you look at how much success he's had. So maybe that personality is too strong for a lot of these players to deal with for a long period of time.
It might very well be. And I go back to a conversation that we've had on the program previous to the season, having Rick Bucher on and doing a radio in the Bay Area. I told him I picked the 49ers to win the Super Bowl this past year. And he said, well, gee, that would mean three NFC championship games in a row, and that's really unlikely. And I said to him, I said, I know, I'm really going against history to say that. Now, they didn't win the Super Bowl, of course, Evan, but they made it back there again. I mean, the magnitude of making it back there repeatedly, and in his first 3 years as head coach, that perfectly exemplifies what you're talking about.
It's an amazing accomplishment. Unfortunately, we live in a society where you got to win it all. You got to win a championship. I mean, I remember living in New York, the Giant fans who love to take shots at the Jets said after Rex Ryan's third year, yeah, I know in the first 2 years he was an AFC title game, but he didn't win anything. He's a loser. What did he win? What does it really matter? So I think, unfortunately, you've got to win it all, and he hasn't done it yet. But when you think about the success that team has had under him, it's really unbelievable. And any team that's able to acquire his services, if indeed they fact move on from him, and if it's your team, which I guess they were rumored to try to be doing, I mean, I'd be ecstatic because the success he's had over a short period of time is really incredible.
It has been amazing. It's been a tremendous run that he's had, and it remains to be seen if he'll burn himself out before they win a Super Bowl at some point. And that is going to be one of the foremost stories in the league, obviously, in the next year or two. You talk about an amazing ride to the top. That takes us to WrestleMania 30 and the culmination of it. This WrestleMania 30, Evan, I have to say, I got accused by some folks of a little bit of prisoner of the moment when I said probably a top five of all time as far as the WrestleManias went. But I'm the kind of guy, I don't know about you, but if there are shows that have bad stretches in them, then I don't want to hear about it. I one of our colleagues on the show has really talked up WrestleMania 10 to me. It had 2 5-star matches. I said the rest of it sucked. It was the worst period in the history of the company. You know, why would I care about WrestleMania 10 on balance? So the fact that 30 didn't have any really bad moments to me, and it had some really excellent action. It didn't have anything I think we'd call 5 stars, but it probably had some 5-star moments if we're looking for that. I was just super enthused about it. What did you think?
You know what? I'm going to make you happy. I think it was one of the greatest WrestleManias of all time, and I'm usually a tough market when it comes to that. But I'll tell you why. What I look for, I look for two things. I look for the moment I'm never going to forget, the moment where, you know, 10, 15 years from now, you're like, yeah, I couldn't believe that. And then the surprise aspect of it, because sometimes WrestleMania becomes way too predictable. Like, as good as Austin Rock was in WrestleMania 15, look, we all knew Stone Cold was going to beat him. So it was predictable. As predictable as Batista beating Triple H was when he took the title from him at WrestleMania 21, I think it was the long buildup that made that one of my favorite main events. It was one of my favorite main events of all time because the buildup was so perfect. And even though I'm pretty sure that the WWE did not plan out Daniel Bryan from SummerSlam, even though it was all luck because the crowd kind of hijacked the shows as the months went on, the long buildup and the final payoff of Bryan going over everybody, including the King, Triple H, in that opening match, which was a great match, I think the culmination of making the fans finally get what they want added to the main event, which made it amazing. The match with Triple H was amazing. And then the Undertaker thing. I mean, I wasn't thrilled with Brock Lesnar being the guy, but gee, that may have been one of the most stunning moments in wrestling history outside of Hogan turning heel. So those two aspects in itself, to me, put it right towards the top. And that's why I'm with you. I think it's one of the greatest WrestleManias we've ever seen.
Exactly. And, you know, that was sort of the Bruno and Koloff moment for our lifetime. We weren't around to see that in the Garden back in 71 when everybody went completely silent with shock. But it's funny because it was the same thing, even though we're in the modern age and everyone being smart marks. In that sense, and the fact that the match didn't have a lot of drama to it, it's because it did seem so predictable, like what you were saying. I think that's one of the reasons that the match kind of plotted, and it was, I thought, one of the bigger disappointments of the day, relatively speaking. Because everybody was like, okay, just waiting for the Undertaker's comeback to win, you know, pull it out of nowhere at the end. So it was an incredible moment at the end. But, yeah, what led up to it? It was the predictability, which in the end was not predictable after all.
They lulled us to sleep. I mean, as the saying goes, they lulled us to sleep with a match that, yeah, you're right, wasn't great, but we just wanted it to end because we thought we knew the ending. And then I think what really topped it off was the way the match ended with the third F5 and then not playing the music, I think was key. I think it was key because you got to hear just the stunned reaction of a crowd. I don't want to call it silence, but it was kind of like this, just this weird reaction from a crowd. And I think the music not playing was perfect. Paul Heyman, who's like a god, that guy's fantastic. Him playing it up was fantastic. Lesnar even, I give him credit, like his reaction of being shocked was great. And then the crowd shots, I mean, was amazing. So it wasn't only the fact that they had him win in such a stunning way. I think the way they scripted out the aftermath was perfect. And, yeah, the match wasn't an all-time classic, but, I mean, it's been how many weeks now, and I'm still kind of stunned by the whole thing. Like, even a few weeks later, it's still like, I can't believe The Undertaker lost at WrestleMania.
It is shocking. It really, truly is. And, again, I have to say, though, one of the – If you read the wrong things on Twitter, I think it can make you lose your faith in humanity. I just kind of blew my stack when I saw one too many people, which I guess would be one for the sake of argument, comparing the end of the streak to the death of the Ultimate Warrior and saying, my childhood is gone. I mean, I'm calling for mandatory sterilization of all the people who conflate that, Evan. You know, they're both shocked. But for the love of God, they're not shocks in the same way. One is actually tragic.
No, that's ridiculous for anybody to think that. And you know what? I think they needed to end the streak. If this was his – see, my whole theory is, and maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong, that this is it. This was his last match. And maybe he realized a few weeks before that he couldn't go again, that this was going to be it. And if he knew this was going to be it, then I'm glad he did lose to Lesnar, because I think a part of wrestling is that you hand the baton off, is that you lose. You don't retire as champion, you know. You don't get to walk away as the king. You kind of have to – now, look, the handoff being to Lesnar is kind of strange. I think we'd all agree with that. But I like the fact that if this was it for him, let him lose. And so I think that's the beauty of wrestling. That's the way it's always been. So obviously comparing it to Warrior is insane. But the more I think about it, the more I'm glad, especially if it's his last match, that that's the way it should end. And this is a guy who, you know, respects the business a lot. We've always heard about that. And I think he probably wanted to lose. And I'm glad he did, even though the guy he lost to was a little strange, especially when he disappears 5 minutes after.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I actually agree with you on that. I've been a proponent of him losing to somebody at WrestleMania before he hangs him up. I actually hoped and thought it would be Batista back in 07. I thought that's what they were building to. Now, history has proven me wrong on that. Batista would not have been the right guy. But, again, it's really interesting to see how it's shaping up. The thing I think that we would also agree was excellent coming out of there in terms of elevating young guys. Cesaro getting his moment with the Battle Royal. An interesting decision putting him together with Paul E. right off the bat there. Where do you think that's going? I've seen rumors about a Lesnar SummerSlam match. I guess it depends on whether or not you believe Lesnar is going to get the title shot at SummerSlam or next year at Mania.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing that annoys me about him. Like, if you're going to have him beat The Undertaker, can he, like, stick around, like, have him feud with Daniel Bryan right away or something like that? Instead, he disappears for months and months. But, yeah, the entire pay-per-view is about promoting young guys, with the exception of John Cena beating Bray Wyatt, which I guess he'll lose now at Extreme Rules or something's going to happen with him. God knows what. But I do think that that was kind of like the future WrestleMania. Like, we finally got to see the future of the company instead of the year before, where we're seeing the recycled Rock Cena main event. Now, this year, we got to see the rise of some of the young stars, Cesaro, even Roman Reigns, who, I mean, it's obvious he's going to be a superstar, and obviously Daniel Bryan. So from that regard, it was almost like the WrestleMania ushering the new era.
Well, the thing about Bryan and Brock, where I will give them, and again, I would like to see Brock around more, and again, he's got that really sweet contract. Props to him for working that out. But yeah, they should be paying him more to come in for more dates, because supposedly he's amenable to doing that. I would agree with holding off on him and Daniel Bryan, just because I think that would be the classic thing of booking yourself into a corner by doing it this soon. Daniel Bryan can't lose the title this early, and the guy that beat The Undertaker can't lose his next match.
No, I agree with that. I guess the only problem I have is that Kane has been a joke for how many months now, and I know he puts the freaking mask on and he's supposed to become Superman again, but I have a tough time really buying into Kane versus Daniel Bryan. It should have been, and I understand why they're doing it, because the whole Evolution thing, it should have been Daniel Bryan versus Randy Orton, considering Randy Orton technically never really lost the match at WrestleMania, or even Batista and Daniel Bryan, and have Daniel go over those guys, or one of them, or both of them, or what have you. It's just, it's tough to buy Kane. This is a guy who 3 weeks ago didn't have a mask on, and he was, like, basically becoming a jobber. Now all of a sudden he's main eventing a pay-per-view with Bryan, but I get your point. I think down the road we'll see Brock Lesnar, but they've got to figure out a way to get him involved more. I mean, especially since he is the guy that ended the streak.
Well, exactly. And in the case of Kane, it's probably going to be a semi-main event with Daniel Bryan, which I have to say, 10 years later, the parallels are shocking. Short little guy wins the main event in a three-way match, gets put into a semi-main event feud with Kane. If I were Brie Bella and Daniel Bryan said something about wanting to buy a house in the Atlanta area, I'd be pretty shocked and disappointed right about now.
I got to tell you, I did not think of that comparison. So you deserve all the credit and or blame for thinking about that. I have not, to be honest with you.
I have a sick mind, Evan. No question.
Clearly.
About that.
Clearly. All on you.
Not a surprise to anybody. But enjoy the Nets game tonight, Evan. I have a feeling it's going to go your way. And, again, one more tremendous conversation with us on the show. We thank you so much for that. And
hey,
look forward to
thank
that
you,
to chat with you.
Thank you, my friend. And remember, root for the Nets, because we are the last great hope to stopping LeBron James in the Eastern Conference. Just remember that. We may not do it, but we give the best chance of anybody to stop him. And I know you want him stopped. So if you want him stopped, all you've got to do is do a nice little chant. It goes like this. Brooklyn, just like that, and hopefully we'll get it done for you.
I hope so. N-E-T-S, Nets, Nets, Nets. Thank you so much, Evan. We really appreciate it. Have a great
Thank
time
you,
tonight.
Man. Have a good one.
Thank you all for joining us today in the FDH Lounge.